Would you like to become like the men of Issachar, who knew the times and knew what to do? Tune in next on Principles and Policies, and we'll do our best to try to fill in those gaps. Hello, this is Chuck Michaelis. I'm the Vice Chairman of the Institute for Principled Policy, and I'm also the Executive Director of Camp American. If you tried to listen to this program last week, and yes, this is a rerun from last week, you noticed that there was a major technical glitch in about the first 15 minutes of Sasha's talk. We're running this again in order to fix that technical glitch. So off to the rest of the program. We have an interesting show for you in that it is a follow-up from something we did last week. And the opening may seem a little confusing to you since we're talking about last week about economics, and we'll be talking about economics. This is the second half of a lecture done by Dr. Sasha Wallachord, who is a pastor in Mount Vernon, Ohio at Knox Presbyterian Church, OPC. But he's also a PhD in economics. He has a European Juris Doctor, a JD, a law degree. He is a former airline pilot with commercial pilot's license. He's a hockey referee. He's just kind of an all-around guy. But in this case, we are calling on him for his expertise in economics. So you might be asking yourself, what does economics have to do with being like the men of Issachar who knew the times and knew what to do? Well, the fact is we live in a period where the economy isn't overly stable. That's not a pleasant thing to realize. But the fact is, we've been in the doldrums in this economy. It kind of started early in the 2000s and was kind of stopped in its tracks. The doldrums were kind of stopped in their tracks a little bit. And then really around 2008, it really hit with a vengeance, with the housing market collapse, a number of banking houses collapsing, a number of very famous long-standing banks got in some very deep trouble. And the reasons are something we're going to talk about today. Sasha is going to be discussing the current economic crisis. Now, you have to remember that this was recorded, I believe, in 2012. And things have not gotten any better, really, since then. There has been some on-and-off talk about this wonderful recovery that we're going through. And if you've been paying any attention lately, and this is being recorded in mid-April of 2014, if we happen to run this as a rerun at some point, this is being recorded in mid-April 2014. So if you hear it, you'll understand what the time was at the time we recorded it. At this time, suddenly you're not hearing anything else about the recovery. It's all assumed that we've all recovered. However, most of us out there who are out there in the economy realize that there really isn't any recovery. And yes, things are not quite as bad as the darkest days, probably around 2009, 2010. But that's only because banks aren't sitting on the verge of collapse. All the banks that were sitting on the verge of collapse did collapse, and in fact were picked up by other banks. The slack was picked up. And we need to understand why those banks collapsed. Now, the idea that we could discuss in what amounts to about a 46 or 47 minute lecture why the banks all collapsed and understand it fully is sort of put to the lie by Sasha himself, and who basically comes right out and says nobody understands exactly how economies work. And that's because, as Sasha explained last week, we don't totally understand how God works in an economy and how God's hand makes itself felt in an economy. We do understand, however, how people who want to be God, that is, government interventionists and central bankers, want to play God by manipulating the system to make it work the way they want to. And that's part of what we're talking about today in our rundown on how economies work and where the current economic crisis has come from and where it is going. So basically, Sasha is going to talk about the current economic crisis, where it came from in general terms, and where we can expect it to go. Now, how does that help you become one of the men of Issachar who know the times and know what to do. If you understand what's wrong with the system, how it's been broken, very often you can go back and fix the system if it's fixable. If it's designed around an unworkable system, then what do? You go back to the drawing board and you redesign the system. Because, let's face it, really, no economy is built on the premise that's false to start with. What happens with is that over time, they evolve into non-working entities. If you study at all the economics of the United States of America, you can see that our economy mostly worked at the beginning through the what amounts to the free market, and it has become a non-working entity by more and more and more and more and more government interventionism, central bank interventionism. And remember that even though we conflate those two things, the government and the central bank, they're really separate entities. Does the government have a hand in the central bank? Yes. But strictly speaking, the central bank is a private entity. And it's a private entity in which government and this private central bank system work hand in hand to essentially have complete control of the economy, or what they believe is the complete control of the economy. Now, the problem with that being that, of course, there is still the market out there. And as much as you want to do things like, well, let's take, for instance, electric cars. Are electric cars necessarily a bad idea? No. Are they necessarily a great idea? Well, it's not a horrible idea. The problem is people don't want them, at least not in the numbers that the government wants them to want them in. So how do they get people to try to want electric cars? Well, they subsidize companies like, well, the big three manufacturers. The Chevy Volt comes to mind. Another big player that comes to mind is the Tesla. And if you'll remember, there was another car company into which the government poured millions upon millions upon millions of dollars, and that was the Fisker Karma. That was going to be the car that was going to take over the market and make everything work right, and suddenly we were all going to want electric cars, that along with the Chevy Volt. Well, the Chevy Volt has sold a few thousand units, maybe a few tens of thousands of units. The fact is, nobody's really enthusiastic about the Volt. You'll see lots of ads on TV for Prius. If you've known people who have Prius, a lot of them love it. They really love the gas mileage because that's generally a hybrid. In other words, it uses both gasoline and electricity. The motor comes on to recharge the battery when it gets low. That kind of thing. What people aren't telling you is that, A, the price is subsidized by the government because they want people to switch over, but B, what happens when the batteries go bad? Or what happens when you get into an automobile accident? And people kind of instinctively understand that. When you have an automobile that if you crash it and the battery cracks, you have to have a hazmat team come out and clean up the toxic spill that comes out of the battery, that may not be the best design available, and that may not be the best thing available. You know, in the old days, there were lots of electric cars in the early days of automobiles, and generally they were marketed to women because, if you'll recall, in the early days of automobiles, you had to hand crank the engine, and women just didn't have the upper body strength to hand crank an engine. So for women, they would market these electric cars, and they used lead acid batteries, just like we use in our current automobiles. Those lead acid batteries that are also toxic. But the new batteries are really toxic. Now, does that mean they're going to stay toxic? Well, if the market comes alive, then the research will go into making far less toxic and far longer lasting batteries. And that is going on. However, it's going on in a subsidized fashion. In fact, it's costing you and me millions of dollars every year to go into these companies because they can't afford to do the research themselves. And in fact, in this particular type of economy that we've evolved into, of course they can't afford that. Normally, the research in a market-driven economy, the research would have happened first, and then people say, you know, we can use this, is a great idea for this would be a car. Well, Not so much nowadays. So what have we got going on? We've got government interventionism that makes it look like cars like Tesla and the Chevy Volt are great ideas, when in fact, right now, they're really not such a hot idea. For instance, if you're a long-distance traveler, and I find myself driving long distances kind of often, for instance, a Chevy Volt can only go about 200 miles, and that's if you don't run the air conditioner or the heater. Then you got to plug in for several hours or to do a battery recharge. The Tesla is attempting to fix this by doing quick recharge stations around the country. And a big deal was made recently about how a Tesla went coast to coast using these quick recharge stations. Well, that's considered to be a big deal, but let's look at it. The first coast-to-coast gasoline-powered automobile went across the United States, and it took months, in something like 1903 or 1908, somewhere in the early part of the last century. So basically, you've got a car that looks really cool. It goes really fast. It has a lot of cachet as a green automobile. But the bottom line is that it's a smoke and mirrors show. People are talking about how affordable they are. Well, the one with almost no accessories on it is $75,000. The top end is in the 150 plus range. So is this a great idea? Well, I personally don't have $75,000 to spend on an automobile. If I have to spend over $12,000 or $13,000, I almost swallow my tongue. So again, this is government interventionism where basically you are being robbed, and most of you out there can't afford a $75,000 car. You are basically having your pocket picked to put money in the pockets of people to subsidize the sale of cars that are $75,000 to $150,000. Well, how does that make you feel? I hope it makes you feel not too happy. Now, that being said, I've kind of gone into depth on one aspect of this, and Sasha's going to go into depth onto a lot more. So we're going to go over to Sasha's lecture, and then I'm going to come back and tell you where you can get more information. Here is Sasha Volacord with the current economic crisis.
...of Christ and a doctor of theology, and I think that's a very, very fitting one and humbling one. Now, when we talk about the economic crisis, there have to be a few caveats at the beginning. And what I tell you now is the deepest of my conviction and understanding, or not understanding. You will hear why I say this. I don't think anyone fully understand what's going on right now. And the reason for that is that let's just compare, or let's just look at the European and the American financial sector, which is so intertwined, so connected, and so intermingled that nobody really understood why the housing crisis of 2007 suddenly drew down all the European stocks. I don't think there is anyone who can stand there and look at the economic crisis and say, well, this is exactly what's going on right now. Everybody is to a certain degree clueless, including me and I'm sure every other economist. But what we can see is the big schemes. What we can see is the big culprits. But under the surface, there are a second, a third, a fourth, a fifth, a 200th line of corruption that plays right into it. So there's so many parasites that are feeding off this system that it's impossible for one person, I believe, to fully grasp it, to understand it, and to who would be able to untwine it or to loosen it all up and lay it open. It would be a blueprint that would be unreadable. And the reason for all of this, in my view, is human nature. Who we know as Christians is corrupt, and we must not forget that. So when human beings can have unjust gain, and there is no Holy Spirit to restrain them, they will go after that gain. And that's what we're dealing with here, and I want to be very clear about that. The reason for the economic crisis is the corruption of human nature. And that must be the first answer that we give. Now, having said that, we can go a little deeper. Now, when we talk about the economic crisis, the first questions that we have to ask, the first question is, which one do you mean? I mean, there's plenty of economic crises out there. There is one huge one in the United States that has been going on allegedly since 2007. There is a huge one going on in Europe. There has been one in Japan. All over the world, there are economic crises, and what we're trying to do now is trace it back to one common culprit, right under human corruption. What we see now is stock markets in turmoil, and if you see predictions, it's just amusing, because people try to explain what's happening in the stock market, and it's like God sitting there and saying, you think? You know, and predictions absolutely don't work, and that's one of the reasons why I tell you nobody really understands what's going on, because we are in a stock market right now that has turned irrational. It has become unpredictable because people are panicking in all directions, and therefore you cannot make proper predictions with the stock market. So the stock markets on both sides of the Atlantic are in turmoil. We have a falling dollar. The only thing that worked for the dollar was that suddenly the euro has started to fall too. I don't know if you realized in the years 2007, 2008, the reaction of China was, and of the Arab countries was, they wanted to switch from the dollar as a lead currency to the euro. And in my point of view, it would have been much smarter to do that at that time. But then the euro started falling, and that came to the rescue of the dollar. So now the dollar doesn't look that bad, because the euro is falling too. Another reason why the dollar is not falling as fast, well, let me rephrase that. I think one reason why the dollar hasn't crashed yet is the big Chinese vacuum cleaner that is standing right beside our printing presses. And let me explain it to you. The United States for a long, long time have been printing money out of thin air, which means they're just producing money. And they tell us it's good for the economy. Well, if it's good for the economy, try it at home and see what they're doing with you, if it's so good for the economy. And when they bring you before a judge, then you say, hey, I've been told at Harvard. I've been told by the president's academic advisors that this is stimulating the economy. I'm a patriot. I want to help this country. And now you want to put me in jail for 25 years on federal charges? What is going on here? So they have been printing money for a long, long time. The printing of money has the same effect as if we suddenly find about 1 billion tons of gold. Let's say we find 1 billion tons of gold down at the bottom of this lake, and we find out about it tomorrow. What would happen with the gold price today? It would fall. So if you have more supply, the price goes down. What if we find silver? What happens to the silver price? Same again. How about bronze? How about coal? How about oil? Is it the same too? My friends, I think there might be a pattern. When we increase supply, the price goes down. What about we increase the supply of money? What happens to the price of money? What we increase money, what happens to the price? Yeah, what is the price of money? The goods we can buy with it. So if we produce more money, the value of money goes down. So we can buy less things. Now we perceive it as the price is rising, right? Because we have more money now, chasing the same amounts of goods. Let's say one of you gave me a little example during the break, and we can give you each a certain amount of monopoly money in this room, and then we can start auctioning a few goods. And at some point, we would be at a certain peak price. And then some guy walks through and gives a few people more money. What would happen to the price of the auction? it goes up. That's exactly what's happening when you increase the supply of money. So thank you for that example. The Chinese vacuum cleaner does what? We print the money, and the Chinese have their big vacuum cleaner right in front of the printing press to suck all those dollars away. Why are they doing that? Because they want to have a strong dollar. Why do they want to have a strong dollar? Because only when this dollar is strong, their goods seem cheap to us. If the dollar gets too low compared to the Chinese currency, Chinese prices seem to go up relatively to the dollar, right? And we don't buy from them anymore. And therefore, the big Chinese vacuum cleaner is sucking away all those newly, or a lot of those newly printed dollars. So that works for us still. So we have a falling dollar. We have high unemployment. They tell us 8.2%. That's what they tell us. There is millions and millions of people who are out of the labor force, who gave up looking for a job. Those people are out of the labor force. They don't count in the unemployment rate. But there are estimations that we're at least at 11%. Yes?
When a small business person who is self-employed goes out of business, they're not counted.
They're not, because they were not employed. They were entrepreneurs. Those are out too, right? So we have at least 11% unemployment rate, and that seems to be an understatement, some would say. But we want to be very careful here that we don't paint the picture that's actually worse. We want to have integrity, because if you start exaggerating things, people can attack you right there, and that invalidates all the arguments for the public. We have high inflation, okay? And that's something the government really lies about. What is inflation? Inflation is the percentage rate of raising of prices per year, usually. Sometimes they give it to us per month, but per year. And usually we had 3%, maybe 4%. I'm absolutely sure we're in the double digits now. The government does hide the inflation rate from us because they have a concept that's called core inflation, where they exclude the price of energy, they exclude the price of foods. Those goods who are most vulnerable for price rising, so they can present to us a very low inflation. Well, it's not that low anymore either, but I'm sure it's in the double digits. Then we have high debt. Well, almost $16 trillion in debt, official debt that the United States have worked up. When Obama took office, we were already at about $9 trillion of debt. And the idea was the old Keynesian idea that you can spend your way out of problems. And let me show you how that works. And you might want to ask your grandparents at some point, because I think in some way our grandparents are better economists nowadays than Harvard PhDs all around the president. But anyway, ask him, Grandpa, when I'm in debt, up to my eyeballs, and I cannot pay it back, do you think it would make sense to get some more debt somehow and spend more? And he would probably ask you if you are drunk. Yeah? And that's the proper question to ask. Now, everybody in his right mind would understand that you cannot spend your way out of trouble. In a time when you are in debt, the premise should be paid back, save. But an economist, the British economist called John Maynard Keynes, in the first half of the last century, kept telling us that we have to spend to stimulate the economy. But Keynes even said it would even make sense to print money, put it in barrels, and bury it around the country and have people pay for digging after them. That would stimulate the economy. The question that I would ask him would be this, Mr. Keynes. What is being produced in all that? Where is real material wealth? Where is investment going? How does it play out for the future when people dig for barrels full of money? Where do you create the jobs? What happens when they found those barrels? Have you created anything? Have you invested anything in the future? It probably takes too long to find it. It should be about $15.86 or $84 trillion in debt now. And if you keep in mind that our GDP has always been around 13, 14 trillion, we have passed the amount of the GDP with debt. Now, what is the GDP? Does anyone know what the GDP is? That's the amount of goods and services. Yeah, 15.8 trillion. And the GDP is the amount of goods and services, everything we produce in 1 year as a country. So if everything that's being produced, every dollar that anyone has earned, everything that has been built, constructed, rebuilt, if all that money for 1 year, we would throw at our debt, it wouldn't even pay it off. That's how deep we are in debt. And as I said, Obama started with around $9 trillion. Now we are at almost 16. And my question is, are we better off now than we were then? And I'm not singling out President Obama here, my dear friends. I might discourage you, but Bush was not much different. My friends, the first bailout was under Bush. The first bailout was Paulson. So the idea, Bush and Obama remind me a little bit of Hoover and Roosevelt. Somebody thinking that it was Roosevelt who invented the New Deal, I have to disappoint you. It was the Republican Hoover who invented the policies of the New Deal. It was just Roosevelt, who was the successor of Hoover, who put them on at work on steroids. It's kind of the same as Bush and Obama. So the Republicans and the Democrats are pretty united. It doesn't matter. They're pretty united in their approach to how we solve economic problems. So therefore, you won't make me very excited about calling me to be a Republican over against a Democrat when it comes to these issues. Just mentioning it, you know. So how did it all start, allegedly? In 2007, we had what was called the housing bubble, a high default rate of subprime mortgages, ARMs or ARMs. That's what we heard, subprime mortgages. Now, nobody ever really explained to us what subprime mortgage is. Well, subprime mortgage are mortgages that were given to low-income people who didn't have very good underwriting circumstances. So if you're a bank and you give money to somebody who has not the best income, well, the person will have to pay for it with higher interest rate, with more risk, because he's a risk borrower. And those are subprime mortgages. And in 2007, thousands and thousands of those just went default. And everybody was asking, well, what was happening here? Well, let me move on before I go back. In 2008, then we had the credit crunch, and everybody thought, oh, what a bad coincidence. Now we just had the housing bubble, still digesting on that one. Now we have the credit crunch, which means banks have no money to lend to anybody, and that's a big problem. And then we heard that people cannot pay payroll because there was no credit in the banks. Well, my dear friends, if you have to pay your monthly payroll on debt, you better close shop anyway. That was just my take on that situation back there. And then we had trillions and trillion after trillion of bailouts later, and the economy now looks worse than ever. Mr. Keynes once again has failed. And I talked with you before about the definition of a complete idiot, right? You do something, it goes wrong, you do it again and again and again. And every time it goes wrong, you still nevertheless do it again. Well, now let me tell you what I think, how it really began. I think it really began with a trip of a few bankers and politicians in 1910 to Jekyll Island. I don't know, is it Georgia or is it South Carolina? It must be. Is it still Georgia? Okay. They went to Jekyll Island, and among those travelers was banker J.P. Morgan and oil tycoon John D. Rockefeller, who were also on that trip. And J.P. Morgan invited, and he paid everything on that trip, and there was a bunch of politicians involved there too, and they wanted, and it was the plan that they wanted to convince the Treasury Secretary and other politicians about. They wanted a banker-owned central bank that could create paper money out of thin air. So this is what, you know, J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller were enemies. They hated each other. But suddenly, they were big buddies because they had one goal. And the goal was cheap credit to expand their empires, which basically means we want the government to be able to print money. And when the government is able to print money, we can have as much credit for the lowest interest rate that we want, and we can increase our empires. And that sounds like a wonderful plan, at least for politicians who are usually not very smart anyway. And I'm saying this with the utmost respect, but if you talk to a congressman, try to talk with a congressman about the connection between inflation and the creation of new money, and they don't even get that, then you really got a problem when these people decide about the fate of this country. Now, on December 23rd, in 1913, Democratic President Woodrow Wilson signed the Federal Reserve Act into law. And that Federal Reserve Act allowed the Federal Reserve Bank to create new money as it pleases them. Now, here's the kicker about the Federal Reserve system. It is under no serious governmental oversight. They can do whatever they want. They can print money, they can set the interest rate, they can increase money supply, they can tighten money supply, they can do whatever they want. And they are not really accountable to Congress or the president. All they can do is they can invite the chairman, which is an interesting name anyway, because chairmans were usually the rulers of communistic nations, but that's an issue for another time for a historian to find out why they call them chairmen. So that's all they can do, invite Bernanke and Mr. Ron Paul, ask his questions, everybody laughs at Mr. Paul, and that's it. The Federal Reserve System keeps on doing what they did. They don't have any public records of their meetings. The board of directors of the board of the Federal Reserve System or the Open Market Committee, they never produce minutes. And under the Clinton administration, a representative from Texas, Henry Gonzalez, made a motion that the Federal Reserve System, the board of directors, should publish. They should be recorded and published within the week. So everybody could see what they talk about monetary policy. And surprising was the reaction of President Clinton, who would say, no, that's not a good idea because it would undercut the credibility of the Fed. Well, how could that happen if they do everything right? How would it undercut? How can transparency ever undercut your credibility? Only if you do crooked things, right? So that was not the smartest move of Mr. Clinton back there. Now, what was before the Federal Reserve System? America was on a gold standard. What does gold standard mean? Gold standard means all the money that a government gives out must be connected with gold. And there must be a link, a fixed link, between the money and the convertibility in gold. For example, if you have, $20?
$20 an ounce is the
what's the standard? Yeah, $20 an ounce, that's how you start out. Now, what is money really, historically? In the old days, people bartered, you know, and bartering became complicated because when you want a root canal, you go to a dentist and you're a carpenter and you say, hey, I have a kitchen table for you. Can you make me a root canal? And he says, I don't need a kitchen table. I need chicken. So you had to go to the farmer and say, hey, can I give you my table for chicken? And I take the chicken to get a root canal. You know, it gets really complicated. At some point, they settled on gold and silver as medium of exchange, mainly gold. And it was the goldsmiths who produced that gold, and they started storing the gold for people because people were not very happy running around with heavy gold when they were rich. So they stored them with the goldsmiths, and the goldsmiths issued certificates of deposit, or CDs. And those certificates of deposit, you could always go back to the goldsmith and say, hey, give me this much gold for my certificate. I needed to pay something. But what was happening then was Everybody accepted those certificates because they knew they were as good as gold. You can just go back to the goldsmith and get your gold back against the certificate. So nobody ever picked up his gold because the certificates were good as gold. And then the goldsmiths got smart. They said, you know what? Nobody ever picks up his gold. Why don't we issue 2 certificates per gold? Because nobody picks it ever up anyway. So they did. And suddenly, there were more certificates out there than there was gold. What happened to the prices of goods? They went up. Because it's like the same example. If you bid on something and I give you more, you have more money to bid. Because you cannot print goods, you can only print certificates. So those certificates of deposit originally were money. That was money, always was. Money was always a certificate that you could prove, hey, I have gold with the bank. It wasn't even the government that ran monetary policy or the monetary system. It were private bankers or goldsmiths. Goldsmith turned into bankers later, and they got all crooked. But the idea was you have a certificate, you have a dollar in your hand, and you have a $20 bill, and you say, this is as good as an ounce of gold. So you could go back to the government, as it would be now, and say, I want my gold. And that would be nice. But then they increased the certificates of deposit. But America, before the gold standard, was off, before the abandoning of the gold standard, it was off and on a gold standard. Before wars, they would abandon the gold standard because they needed money to pay for the war. So they abandoned the gold standard. It was before the Civil War, the War of Independence. You know, they had the Continental. You know the saying, it's not worth the Continental. And then World War I, they abandoned the gold standard. World War II, more and more. And so therefore, there was a gold standard that was off, on and off. As I said, money was certificates of gold, certificates of deposit for gold. That was money, always was. I mean, most of us grew up not even thinking about money was money. Nobody thinks about it. Money was a carrier of value, and in everybody's perception, money is valuable. And as we said, value is subjective. In this case, not very helpful, because the only reason why money still works is because people think it has a value. But once people understand, and it's not really hard to understand, it's just paper with print on it with no real value inherent, then people will have a problem. The banks will have a problem, and the country will have a problem, even more than it already does. So with the gold standard, the government could only print money when there was gold for it. So only when somebody brought gold to the government, they could issue, or the government bank, they could issue a banknote. And then came 1914, when the gold standard was completely suspended. Okay, the Federal Reserve Act. So the Federal Reserve didn't have the obligation to have the money that they print available in gold. It started partially, you know, first 40% backed in gold, and you know, you can print 2.5 times the money that you have in gold and so on. But officially and legally in 1914 until 1919, for the reason of World War I, they completely abandoned the gold standard because there was a war again, okay? And then in 1944, the victory powers, as we call them, met in Bretton Woods. That's a hotel in New Hampshire. I don't know if you ever heard about Bretton Woods. The victors of World War II, nobody knows why the Soviet Union was among them, but hey, what do I know? So they went back, they had a guy invited, and his name you already heard, John Maynard Keynes. A very wicked man, I have to say, and I think in this context it can be said. He was a member of a secret society at the university where he was, and he was a very adulterous, homosexual, very, very wicked man. And he was there invited as a chief economist at Bretton Woods, and he talked the countries into accepting a quasi-gold standard for the United States. It was towards the end of World War II, 1944. And he said, well, and that's what they agreed on. The dollar remains the lead currency. and everything is really traded in dollars. The foreign countries buy lots of dollars, and they buy it with gold. And they have a guarantee. Governments and foreign official institutions had the guarantee to exchange their dollar back into gold for a fixed rate of $35, I think it was, per ounce. So that was a guarantee. You take the dollar as a lead currency, all you foreign countries buy dollars, and we have this guarantee that whenever you foreign governments want to exchange a dollar back into gold, into your gold, you can get an ounce for $35. That was a fixed rate that was set. Of course, the U.S. government couldn't keep their word. Not couldn't, but didn't want to keep their word. They started printing money again. They lowered the interest rate, so they bring money out. They try to stimulate the economy. And in 1971, the Republican Nixon, once again, we have a Democrat-Republican cooperation in deceiving the American people. Nixon suspended totally the convertibility for dollars in gold, because they had only about $18 billion in gold and $36 billion in outstanding debt.
Nixon actually said, "We are all Keynesians now."
Yeah, that's a very sad day, yeah? And it was basically, when Obama was elected, I think that was even a headline in Time magazine. Well, shortly, a socialist, yeah, which is about the same. So from that time on, so Nixon gave the death blow, the Republican Nixon gave the final death blow to the Democrats' Wilson idea of Federal Reserve System and moving away from a gold standard. And Nixon completed it. So once again, a bipartisan, as they call it so wonderfully, bipartisan effort. But this is what is being denied, that there is an inseparable link between monetary expansion and inflation. And I very vividly remember one story with a colleague when I was teaching at the University System of Georgia. We had a guy, he did some advisory work, an economist for the NBA, and he was dealing with the contracts and so on. And you know, my students found that cool, so I invited him into my class. We were kind of friends there. And he talks about the MBA and he talks about economics, and somehow he asked the question, so where do you think inflation comes from? And you have to keep in mind, I had these students for a while before that. And it was like music in my ear, because like a chorus they sang out, because of the printing of money. And the guy was a mainstream economist, he got pale. And he said, you cannot prove this. You cannot prove this. If we knew this, we would be rich people living somewhere in the Caribbean. And that gives you an idea how ideological academia has become. So the state institutions and the secular institutions are full of economists who would always agree with the supply curve and the demand curve. They would always agree that if you increase supply, the price goes down for every other good than money. For some strange and mysterious reason, this link between increasing of supply and the decreasing of value doesn't exist with money. And we have this saying in German, and I use it quite a bit when it comes to ideological issues. What must not be, cannot be. Or, the wish is the father of the thought. And that's what academia does. They have their presuppositions, they are liberals, and they say, well, Keynes is right, Marx is right, Obama is right, whatever somebody tries to say against it, we will crush him with whatever we can. And that, my friends, is the reason why economics is so complicated nowadays, why there's so much mathematics, so much calculus, so much graphical confusion there, because this is how the economics class works in the state university. You sit in there and you have an economist immersing you with stuff that's way over your head. Equation, usually a Chinese guy. Equations, functions, graphs, and you just sit there and say, what in the world is he talking about? Now the deal is this. You do what he says, you get your B and you're fine. Maybe a C. But if you start arguing with him, you're dead meat. You will never pass that class. And when you ask a question like, but sir, the increase of money is like the increase of gold. If you have more supply, the price goes down. Why would you say that the printing of money does not increase prices in the long run? He would come with a huge function. Yeah, and he would ask you, do you get it now? And you would say, yeah, I guess so. And this is how they do it. Economics is so easy of a science that it's almost embarrassing that they give out PhDs for it. All they've done is, hey, who has read at least parts of The Wealth of Nations? Okay, how many equations and graphs are in there? I never saw one. And still those guys call Adam Smith the father of modern economics. That's how you know they've never opened that book. Because they're all about mathematics, they're all about statistics, they're all about calculus. Yes, sir?
All inflation ends up being is organized theft.
Oh, yeah.
That's all it is.
It is. It is, exactly. The government has a few possibilities to gain money. They can tax you. They can borrow, either from domestic or from outside. And they can print money. Now, when they tax you, they're always facing the possibility of a taxpayer revolt. When they borrow, the same holds true because taxpayers have to pay it back. But when they do inflation, when they print money and present it to you as, well, inflation is just the reality of economics as they did and as they do, then you never find out that it's what they call, inflation is called therefore a hidden tax. It's a very convenient way of taxation. They just print money, spend it, and suddenly you see the value of your dollar or the buying power of your dollar going down. This is what inflation does. And then they talk about business cycles. Let me show you how a business cycle works. Let's say here we have a baseline. And let's say we have a market that works. That's a universal worldwide disease. Markers that, wherever I go, markers know. Did these things dry out so quickly? Let's say we come here on the baseline. And I call it baseline because that's somewhere we have to start. And suddenly they see, well, the economy is going down, the GDP is going down, the unemployment rate is going up. And politicians get nervous because we got to do something about it. And you know what they do? They have only one recipe. Turn on the printing press and lower the interest rate. Because when they turn on the printing press, they supply more money to the banks, they lower the interest rate, people will borrow because the interest rate is low. And suddenly, indeed, you see a little stimulation of the economy. Suddenly it goes up fast. It goes up fast. People have money. They spend it. They have cheap credit. So the money hits the market. But when the market catches on that there is more money, and suddenly there's more demand for all goods, all kinds of goods, what happens to the prices? Prices go up. And suddenly the economy slows down again. Because they start printing money, they're afraid of too high of inflation. They do all this in hiding, you see. When we suddenly have 20% inflation, people will ask something's wrong. So they stop printing money because they're afraid of inflation. And there it goes down again. Oh my, what shall we do? We just had election. We got to do something. What do we do? Help me. We print more money. Oh, look. Oh, it goes down again. We got to stop printing money. And more. And here's my question. Have you ever seen a pickup truck go too fast with a boat or a trailer behind himself? And the trailer starts to... What happens? Then he applies the brakes. Worst thing you can do, it gets more. Then he steps on the gas pedal. He wants to get this hanger out of going left and right. And that's when it happens. Bye-bye, boat. This is where we are right now. Since 1914, we have done this. We got a kick in our butts in the 30s, and several times later on. You know, they say that the Great Depression came about by free market policies of Hoover in the 20s. No. The Great Depression came with this sudden increase of monetary supply since 1914. The Roaring 20s were already an upswing. And then we paid for it heavily in the 30s because we just had started printing money. And from there on, economists will tell you we have business cycles, just the reality of economics. Well, go to the internet and look up the inflation rate under a gold standard. You will not see any. So the business cycles, as they call them, business cycle is boom and bust cycles. You know, boom and bust. Yeah, they have a remote control, and that remote control is the printing press. And this is why we have business cycles. When we were on the gold standard, there were no business cycles. There's hardly any inflation. The only inflation you have on the gold standard is if for some reason the demand for some good suddenly goes up. And that's a good thing. If you think of Katrina, for example, when suddenly they predicted this horrible hurricane and suddenly the prices for plywood went up, I mean, tremendously. Well, why did it go up? Because the demand in New Orleans in that areas were so high. So everybody who needed plywood for building anywhere else in the country stopped building for a while because plywood was so expensive. That's a good thing. That's the invisible hand saying, hey, plywood is needed here. Everybody else stopped buying plywood. So you don't need a government saying everybody else is prohibited from buying plywood and all plywood is being sent there. Prices do it. So the price for plywood went up because it was needed there. And nobody else bought plywood. And this is the kind of inflation you have temporarily under a gold standard. But you don't have business cycles. You don't have this continuous inflation. Please write it down if you have a pen. When you're home and you have internet access, go to an inflation calculator. And resolve the following example. Let's say grandma started saving in 1980. And she wanted to have something one day when she has grandchildren in 2010 or 2011 to give them, to buy each of them a car. And let's assume that grandma saved $20,000 under her mattress. I mean, this lady saved. And see what she could buy with $20,000 in 1980 and what she can buy now. In 1980, she could have bought three cars easily, I would think. Maybe two. I don't know. She could buy much more. I wasn't here in 1980, so I don't know. We had our own problems in Europe. So, and that's exactly what you sort of said before. It is theft. Grandma had a certain buying power under her mattress. And that buying power was stolen to a big part by the government, reaching under her mattress. Ma'am, you were first then. Okay, now I'm getting myself in trouble, I'm sure. Yeah. 5 minutes, okay. I can do that. Reagan was a good guy. The one thing I miss about Reagan when I hear all this, I mean, people are desperate right now, and everybody calls for Reagan, but the one thing that I don't understand, I mean, Reagan gave us the Laffer curve. Reagan... you know, his economic advisor, Mark Laffer, he produced the Laffer curve, which was true. Reagan cut the taxes about in half across the board in the 80s, and still tax revenue doubled. Okay? Reagan said, you just lower the taxes, leave more money in people's pockets, and they will produce more because they have an incentive to work hard. And the problem with Reagan, and that was a good idea, Reagan, I think, even attempted the gold standard, but I think he gave that up rather quickly because of a hostile Congress. But the fact that seems to be forgotten about Reagan is he was a heavy spender. And if you ask me if we need Reaganomics now, I say, yes, without the spending. Yes, we need lower taxes. We need to stimulate the economy by leaving more money in people's pockets, but we don't need the heavy spending. Yeah, I hope I didn't get myself too deep into problems now.
To tie this up back to our personal responsibility, lots of people benefit from inflation while it's occurring. The banking industry, which are our local bankers, the real estate industry, very many people benefit, and that's why we have to reach them with the truth of Christ.
Oh yeah.
Because they need to see what their personal responsibility is and be willing to be truthful.
Well, it's definitely, and that's the result of all of this, it's what it's doing, it's using wrong weights and measures. And that's basically prohibited, not basically, it's strictly prohibited in Scripture.
And by the Constitution.
And by the Constitution, exactly. But that's exactly the problem. They're using false measures. They're devaluing our money. They're reaching into our pockets without ever touching us, you know. And that's the big problem. Now, you know, who else profits from inflation? I hate to say it. People who are heavily in debt, as long as you have a fixed interest debt, you know, because if all the prices rise, the price of your labor rises too. Suddenly you have more income because of the lacking buying power of the money, but your mortgage remains at the same interest rate. And so and that's what some politicians or good pundits mean when they say we're living on cost of the future right now. You know, we devaluate our currency, but we have our properties that we bought on debt locked in a certain interest rate. Just think of the Weimar Republic in Germany. They had this runaway inflation. That's, by the way, something I expect in the next few years, either here in Europe, wherever it starts first, and then one will then drag down the other. But in the Weimar Republic, they suddenly had, you know, 1,000% inflation a day or something, you know, and the men in the factories were paid twice a day. Their wives came with wheelbarrows, and they carried home the banknotes where they printed even higher amounts on the money. So they would earn a trillion marks a day, and they would use it eventually as heating device, the money, because it was more valuable for heating than to pay things. Now imagine you have a mortgage that has $150,000 or marks open, and it's fixed interest, and suddenly you get $1 trillion a day. Well, you pay back that mortgage in 2 seconds of work, you know? So that's why the government has led Americans into debt, because people in debt love inflation, and that's how they bought them. There is much more to say about this, but you hit the nail on the head. It is theft, and that's why it's wrong. Inflation, the printing of money is theft, and that's why it shouldn't be done. And the government having all this power, redistributing stuff, is based. The government cannot produce wealth. Everything the government gives to somebody, it has to steal before that from somebody else. And therefore, it's a violation of the commandment, thou shalt not steal. And it lures Americans into envy and covetousness. And that, therefore, it's also a violation of the 10th commandment, thou shalt not covet. Because the whole split into two Americans, America wealthy, they have and they have not. That's in core and in essence a violation of the 10th commandment. The whole political system of big government builds on the violation of the 10th commandment. He has, you don't, you have a right to get it. And the government can only give it to you if it first steals it from the other guy. And therefore, we're living under a very, very immoral government situation. Now, here's my prediction. It has to get worse before it gets better, and this is also my hope. I'm not a doomsday guy or something. These things have happened before. I think the economy will collapse, maybe worldwide, at least America and Europe. And my hope is that at that time, we are ready to rebuild this nation on firm, not only constitutional ground, but even better on biblical ground. That is my hope. Thank you.
If you want more information on what you just heard, you can go to www.campamerican.com. That's www.campamerican.com. And you can get a copy of this lecture in video format that has all the PowerPoint slides and that kind of thing. Again, www.campamerican.com. If you can't find that, or you need more information, you can get a hold of us at www.principledpolicy.com. That's principledpolicy.com. And we ask that you join us again next week for another Principles and Policies.